Tonight's topic is entitled, Do I Have to Believe in Hell? Many of you have been moved by the ethical teachings of Jesus this week. How many have learned something about what Jesus taught that you didn't know before when you came this week? You're seeing Jesus in a new light. That makes it all worth it. I think that we're going to be, for quite a long time yet, discovering new insights into what Jesus actually taught us. And we've seen over and over again that Jesus really does, His teachings do have relevance to our lives and the world we live in the 21st century. God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through Him might be, do you remember? Healed. That's right. And we saw how what Jesus taught has the capacity to set in motion healing in our world. We've also looked at some of the other challenging things as far as justice. Think about Jesus' death on the cross. We talked about this last night. The unjust execution of Jesus. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing. Remember, Jesus didn't say, Father, I'm going to forgive them because I trust that vengeance is yours and one day you'll get them. He was going so far as to say, Father, I forgive them. I want you to forgive them as well for this because they don't know what they are doing. I want to submit to you tonight, before we even look at the topic of hell, some of you have said, I want to follow this Jesus that I've seen this week, but do I have to buy this Christian teaching of hell? It just doesn't fit. I want to remind you that before we even look at this, the clearest picture of God that we get is the picture of God suspended upon a Roman cross saying, Father, forgive them. Not asking for retaliation. Not saying, Father, get even with them for this. Not eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Father, don't hold this against them because they don't know what we are doing. We saw on night number two, on Tuesday night, where Jesus talks about the eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. How many were here for that night, by the way? Gandhi himself said, an eye for an eye leaves the whole world, do you remember the statement? Blind. And for many of us, our picture of God has been of a God who's an eye for an eye kind of God. We think Jesus came and died because God needed His eye. Are you hearing me? And many people's, their idea of hell, their definition of hell, has been, it's going to be that moment when those who have accepted Jesus, finally, God is able to execute a cosmic, divine eye for an eye. They're finally going to get what's coming to them. And that's what I want to challenge tonight. Whatever you believe about Jesus' death, as we looked at last night, and whatever you believe about Jesus's, or about the topic of hell that we're looking at this evening, neither one of those topics or what we believe about those topics can we allow to contradict the clear teachings of Jesus, where He said, I know you've heard an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I'm telling you, do not retaliate against an evil person. The death of Jesus nor hell is God's retaliation against sinners for sin. Are you hearing what I'm saying tonight? We do not serve a God, we do not see a God in Jesus whose chief attribute is retributive or punitive justice. The God we see in Jesus defines justice as being restorative justice. It's that which we bring to those who are being oppressed, those which are the victims of violence, those who are suffering from injustice. So how do we make sense out of it? If the traditional view of hell is correct, there are some contradictions. Look at it in your grace section for a moment. Matthew 5:44, there in the middle, it says, I tell you, love your, what does it say? Your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. There's a troubling contradiction between a God who would burn His enemies forever and ever and ever and ever, and Jesus who calls us to love our enemies. It seems that Jesus is asking us to live up to a higher ethic than even God Himself does. Are you with me? Look at it in Psalms 30, verse 5. For His anger lasts only for a moment, but His favor, or some translations say love or mercy, lasts forever. It would seem that if the traditional teaching of hell these days is correct, that verse should say that His anger lasts forever and ever, and that His love or His mercy only lasts for a moment, only a lifetime. But if you don't take advantage of it in this lifetime, then you're going to have to suffer His anger throughout the ceaseless ages of eternity. You've seen the bumper stickers, eternity, where will you spend, smoking or non-smoking? How many have seen, you know what I'm talking about? The turn or the burn, the threatenings. In Isaiah 54 verse 8, it says, "In a surge of anger I hid my face from you for a moment, but with everlasting kindness I will have compassion on you." What I want you to notice is that the anger is temporary or eternal? Temporary. It's the mercy, the compassion, the kindness that is everlasting. How many can see that? And yet it would seem that if the traditional teaching of hell is correct, we would have to say that His kindness is temporary and that His anger is eternal. Do you see it? Look at it again in Lamentations 3, 31 through 33. Here's a troubling contradiction. The people are not cast off by the Lord for how long? Forever. You're not cast off by the Lord forever, it says. Though He brings grief, He will show what? Compassion. So great is His unfailing love, He does not willingly bring affliction or grief to any human being. The greatest troubling contradiction that we find is John's three, after spending 3.5 years with being mentored by Jesus. He sums up God's essence by these three words. Someone once said to me, "Herb, can you just sum up what you preach in one paragraph?" I said, "I can do it in three words. God is love." But how do you reconcile that with a God who says, "But if you don't love me back, I'm going to kindle literal fire on your skin throughout the ceaseless ages of eternity"? You wouldn't do that to a pet. Are you with me? Think about that. Let's say a dog contracted rabies. Would you, maybe the dog needs put down. Are you with me? How would you put that dog down? Would you douse it with petrol and light a match? How many would grant that's inhumane? So we must be very careful how we define this subject of hell. No doubt, the Bible speaks about a hell. But we have to understand even that in the light of Jesus' teachings on the Sermon on the Mount. In Revelation 21:4, the Apostle John wrote, "There will be no more what? Mourning, crying, or what? Pain. For the old order of things has," what does it say? God is seeking to restore this world. He's not trying to immortalize suffering, pain, torment, and torture. He's endeavoring to bring it to an end where it is no more. These are some troubling contradictions. If the traditional teachings of hell is correct, then you're going to have to at least ask the questions, how do these verses fit into that? How many can at least see we've got a quandary here on our hands? If it's true, how do we make sense out of these verses with that? Let's jump into the Jesus story tonight, and let's just meet it right head on. Let's start in Luke 16, 19 through 31, where it seems that Jesus is teaching the traditional view of hell. "There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a" what? Talk to me. "A beggar named" who? "Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried in Hades." That's an interesting word. The Hebrews, note this, did not believe in Hades. Hades is a Hellenistic Greek term. Just note that. Circle it and write down Greek. This is Greek influence. You'll understand why that's important in a moment. In Hades, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw who? Abraham far away. Now, in jokes that transpire today, when someone dies and they show up at the pearly gates, who do they usually meet there at the pearly gates? St. Peter, that's right. But during this time, when the Hebrews talked about dying and going somewhere, they would get to the pearly gates, so to speak, and they wouldn't meet Peter, because Peter wasn't known yet. Who would they meet? Father Abraham, that's right. And it says, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue because I am in agony in this fire. What I want you to notice in the parable, even though this is a small tangent, is how is the rich man still treating Lazarus? Do you see it? As his servant. He's still objectifying a human being, using them for his own best interest. Can you see that? And then continue on. It says, but Abraham replied, son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here and you are in agony. And besides all of this, between us is a great chasm and has been set in place so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us, he answered. Then I beg of you, Father, send Lazarus to my family, for I have how many brothers? Five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place of torment. Abraham replied, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. No, Father Abraham, he said, if someone from the dead goes to them, they will what? He said to him, if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone, what does it say? Was someone going to come back from the dead? Who was ultimately the one that was going to be brought back to life? Jesus. And even though Jesus would be resurrected, if they weren't following how Moses pointed forward to Jesus and listening and embracing Jesus in the here and now, they wouldn't believe even if Jesus came back to life. We know that's true because when you look at the Jesus story, how did the people Jesus is speaking to today treat the news that Jesus had come back to life? Did they believe it? Or did they try to cast a disparaging doubt on it? So we see some interplay here. What I want to give you is some cultural background. In Jeremiah's book, Parables, page 183, this is what he writes. This is an Old Testament scholar on Jesus' parables. In order to understand the parable in detail, and as a whole, it is essential to recognize that this first part, it derives from a well-known folk material. This is the Egyptian folk tale of the journey of Osiris, the son of, and you can go through, yeah, when he goes to the underworld. Alexandrian Jews, that's Greek Jews, brought this story to where? Palestine, where it became very popular as the story of the poor scholar and the rich publican. Interesting. What I want you to notice is the rich, what does it call him? A rich what? Who were the publicans? They were the tax collectors. In other words, traditionally when this story was told by the Jews, an old folk tale, it was told about a tax collector and a beggar. Got it? How did the Pharisees feel towards tax collectors? Sinner or righteous? Sinner. Good, 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 good. Speak up to me tonight. Sinner or righteous? Sinner. And notice what Jesus is doing here with the parable. Jesus is taking this familiar story to them, and instead of there being a publican in its place or a tax collector in the place of this rich man, he's speaking to wealthy Pharisees in the context of Luke 16. You can look up the context when you go home tonight. He's speaking to Pharisees who love money and want to serve both God and money. And Jesus says, you can't do both. But instead of placing it as a tax collector, Jesus is putting who in the place of that character in this story? He's putting them. Would that have been offensive to them to say that in your wealth and your ignoring of the poor and marginalizing the poor, you are no different than a tax collector? Would that have been offensive to them? Absolutely. Jesus is pressing the button. What I want you to notice in all of this is that Jesus is not describing what happens to a person when they die. Jesus is using a story that already existed in their folklore, and he's pushing home the point. This is how we should take care of the poor. Is this a parable where Jesus is trying to establish theology, or is this another parable where Jesus once again is trying to establish ethics? What have we been looking at all week? Talk to me. Ethics. Jesus is using this story that was already within this culture to push forward the ethic that we looked at Wednesday night, which was, if we have surplus, what should we do with it? Give it away to the poor. Did this man have surplus? Numerous versions of this story are found in the ancient world, including the one in this tradition of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Luke 16:14, just a few verses previous, it says the Pharisees, who were lovers of, what does that say in your grace section? Money, heard all this, and they what? Ridiculed him. Did someone come to Jesus and say, "Hey, Jesus, tell me what happens when a person dies"? Is that the context? No. What's the context is that the Pharisees were ridiculing him over how he said, "Take your surplus and give it to the poor." And so Jesus tells them the famous folklore story, but instead of the tax collector, once again, who's in that place of the rich person? Them, they are. Do you see what Jesus is doing here? It is vital that we don't read too much into this. In Luke 6:20, Jesus says, looking at his disciples, he said, "Blessed are you who are what? Poor, for yours is the," what does it say? "The kingdom of God. But woe to you who are rich." You see, the Pharisees and certain ones who had been influenced by Greek teaching in this culture believed that there was coming a great reversal, where the rich would suffer and the poor would finally be fed. But according to the folk tale, when did most people believe that was going to happen? When they, according to the folk tale, when they what? When they died. But Jesus in his Sermon on the Mount is saying that reversal that you're expecting post-mortem, it's not when you die. I've come to create the great reversal when? Now. You who are poor, remember the pyramid? Flipping it upside down? You who are poor, you're going to be blessed by this kingdom that I've come to establish. And you who are rich, don't look for when you die. The great reversal is now. The kingdom starts now. Once again, Jesus is always drawing us away from post-mortem realities to how we live our life today. It's interesting, too, that the tribe of Judah was the only tribe left in Jesus.